software on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, the IMF says the red ink pouring from the United States could drown the world's economy.
President Bush pays his first visit to Florida's Palm Beach County, where Al Gore actually won the popular vote in 2000. Protesters expected to greet the president today.
Democratic activists in Palm Beach and Broward County, which is just south to us, home of Fort Lauderdale, they're quite angry, and there are some of them who believe that, it gets the juices flowing and will bring out the numbers they need.
Also, the politics of tax cuts for the middle class.
And Connecticut Governor John Rowland apologizes, but is it too late?
These stories and Outkast shakes it like a Polaroid picture, coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall. The U.S. military says an Army Black Hawk helicopter crashed today during an emergency landing west of Baghdad near the town of Fallujah. NPR's Emily Harris in Baghdad reports all nine aboard were killed in today's incident, which is not the first in Iraq.
There have been a number of helicopter incidents that have killed U.S. military personnel. In the middle of November, there was an incident when two Black Hawk helicopters collided in Mosul. They were apparently coming under fire at that point. 17 soldiers were killed during that incident. Another incident recently, just a couple of days ago, an observation helicopter was shot down in central Iraq, and one pilot was killed and another one injured.
NPR's Emily Harris in Baghdad. Army Brigadier General Mark Kimmett says it's not clear yet why the helicopter crashed.
The cause of the crash is unknown at this time. A quick reaction force has secured the area, and an investigation is underway.
Fallujah is a flashpoint of resistance to the U.S. occupation of Iraq. Aid workers say a 56-year-old man has been rescued alive nearly 2 weeks after a devastating earthquake hit southeastern Iran. Experts say it's rare for people to survive for more than 72 hours in earthquake rubble. Roxana Saberi reports from Tehran.
A doctor in Bam says rescue workers found the man trapped under a wardrobe, which seems to have saved his life. The physician says the patient, named Jalil, was in poor health and has slipped into unconsciousness. He did not have access to food, but the ruins of his home where he was found were wet. The man is the first survivor found in the area since a woman in her late 90s was rescued on January 3rd. The December earthquake killed more than 30,000 people and left thousands more homeless. Most of Bam's buildings were made of mud bricks, which easily collapsed during the earthquake, trapping people underneath with no room to breathe. The UN International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies are calling for countries to donate $75 million to help pay for rebuilding and relief efforts. I'm Roxana Saberi in Tehran.
An American tourist has been killed in Guatemala. 52-year-old Brett Richards was a passenger on a minibus that was hijacked in southwestern Guatemala. A Guatemalan police spokesman says the bus was forced off the road by the hijackers, then attacked with automatic weapons. Richards was a Mormon from Ogden, Utah. He was traveling in Guatemala with 12 other Mormons. Richards was apparently shot in the chest during the hijacking. Local police say the gunman robbed everyone on board and then fled. Many Mormons believe that archaeological ruins in Central America were built by people described in the Book of Mormon. Travel agencies arrange tours to those sites. On Wall Street today, the Dow is up about 42 points at 10,571 in heavy trading of 784 million shares. The Nasdaq is up about 11 points. This is NPR. Enron's former chief accountant may be negotiating a plea bargain with prosecutors. The deal would reportedly send Andrew Fastow to prison and fine him millions of dollars. Fastow was accused of creating financial deals that hid Enron's debt and increased its stock price. Kraft Foods is shaking up its organizational structure. The Illinois-based company says the restructuring will give it a global marketing strategy. From Chicago Public Radio, Lisa Labez reports.
Kraft is the world's second-largest food company and markets Oreo cookies, Jell-O desserts, and Oscar Mayer hot dogs in more than 150 nations. The realignment will move all Kraft units at a complex in Rye Brook, New York, to new locations. Kraft's parent company, Altria Group, is putting the suburban New York City building up for sale because of the pending employee relocations. About 1,000 people work at that complex, most for Kraft, but some for other Altria companies, including Philip Morris. The Kraft restructuring will also reshuffle some executives, but Kraft has so far not discussed any possible employee layoffs. Kraft says it will disclose staffing levels on January 27th when it releases its final 2003 results. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Labus in Chicago.
The nation's major retailers released their December results today. They say last-minute shoppers helped them salvage holiday sales, although some companies say heavy markdowns eroded their profits. Luxury stores were the biggest winners. Tiffany & Company reported a 16% jump in holiday sales at U.S. stores open for at least a year. Nordstrom posted a 9% increase in December sales. I'm Nancy Marshall, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and from Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
$47 trillion. That's the budget shortfall that the International Monetary Fund is predicting for the United States over the next 70 years. The IMF economists are also warning that the U.S. deficit and burgeoning trade imbalance could bring down the entire global economy. The IMF has criticized U.S. fiscal policy before, but yesterday's report includes some especially blunt language. So for more, we turn to Stephen Leslie. He's managing editor with the Economist Intelligence Unit, affiliated with Economist Magazine in New York. And Stephen, we've heard a lot about the U.S. deficit, a consequence of tax cuts, increased government spending on war and anti-terrorism, and the shaky economy. But why does the IMF see this as a threat to the economy of the whole world?
Well, the main reason is that the U.S. economy is such an important part of the global economy. You know, we sometimes lose sight of that, but our economy really makes up a very large percentage of all of global output, and everything that we do, even if we don't know we're having these effects, has impacts on other countries around the world.
Well, we just mentioned the prediction of a $47 trillion shortfall. How is that number arrived at, briefly?
Well, that's a little bit of a – I think this is very solid work that the IMF has done, but it's a little bit unorthodox. What we usually look at is the budget deficit and debt that a country has. Now, what they've done is they've looked at unfunded liabilities, and these are quite hard to estimate, although everybody does believe that they're important. And so the work that they've done is a bit it's a bit pioneering, I'd say, in order to try and calculate what these unfunded liabilities are. That is things like Social Security, mm-hmm. Medicare, which we know there's going to be more spending on, and other sorts of programs that are associated with the aging population.
Well, could you put this in further context? I mean, we read that the U.S. debt to the rest of the world could soon be as much as 40% of the total U.S. debt, and that's a lot of external debt. But does that make the U.S. the next Argentina?
No, I don't think there's any reason to believe that. First of all, the problems that we're suffering in terms of the fiscal deficit and debt are small in comparison with those of Argentina. And besides, the U.S. has a very vigorous economy that has been able to continue to grow. Now, I think the IMF's concerns are very legitimate ones. I'm concerned about these things myself. But there's no need to exaggerate it.
And other countries also have huge deficits. I'm thinking of Japan, for instance.
Well, that's right. Actually, you know, these calculations are somewhat frightening for the United States. But if you compare our situation to that of countries like Japan or some of the countries in Europe, our situation actually looks a little bit better than theirs. And the IMF has been pointing that out. So there's nothing extraordinary about them making these kind of warnings for the U.S. now.
Well, in fact, Bush administration officials have, you know, brushed off the report. They say the president has pledged to cut the deficit in half over the next 5 years. Is that likely to mollify the IMF?
Well, they took that into some account in their, at least in their press conference yesterday, and in their paper. Although the administration plans to cut it in half, cut the budget deficit in half, are still kind of sketchy. We don't know where those savings are going to come from. But the IMF did take that into account, and they remain concerned, even if the Bush administration accomplishes that, that is not enough enough of improvement in our fiscal position.
Well, the IMF isn't the only group with these strong concerns. Former Secretary of Treasury Robert Rubin presented a paper last week and saying somewhat the same thing, that the U.S. economy could drag down the world economy if it continues. Very, very briefly, does the IMF lay out any suggestions?
Well, they do, in fact. You know, somewhat surprisingly, they do lay out some ideas about what could be done to bring down U.S. budget deficits and improve our position. One is to put the spending caps in place that used to be there. Another one is tax hikes, you know, a very political issue. And a third is reform of Social Security and Medicare programs, so there's less spending on them in the future.
And as you say, this is a presidential election year. Probably not a lot of movement on those this year.
I don't expect any at all.
Well, Stephen, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Stephen Leslie, managing editor of the Country Finance with the Economist Intelligence Unit. He spoke to us from New York.
Later today, President Bush arrives in Palm Beach County, Florida, for a four-hour fundraising visit. Now, ordinarily, a visit like this wouldn't be that big a deal for a chief executive who spends a lot of time traveling around to raise money. But this is President Bush's first visit to the county of butterfly ballots, hanging chads, and recounts since the presidential election of 2000. Al Gore won the popular vote in Palm Beach County back then. So what can President Bush expect to see and hear after he touches down? Brian Crowley is political editor of the Palm Beach Post. Brian, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Brian, thanks a lot for joining us. Just a quick agenda. Where's the president going, and how much money does he hope to raise?
Well, he's spending most of the day today in Tennessee, but he's going to take a few hours out of his day to raise about $750,000 at the posh resort in Palm Beach County. Is there anything else but posh resorts in Palm Beach County? It's a very closed event unless you've ponied up $2,000. But on his motorcade route, he's got about a 20-minute drive. He'll probably see a few protesters along the way.
He'll be raising $750,000, but the protesters will line up not having had to pay a $2,000 fee to pay for it. How many do you think there'll be? Are people still angry down there in great numbers?
Well, I think that the Democratic activist in Palm Beach and Broward County, which is just south to us, home of Fort Lauderdale, they're quite angry, and they would like to relive the whole 2000 election over again. And needless to say, there are some of them who believe that, you know, it gets the juices flowing and will bring out the numbers they need. But on the other hand, people I've talked to, including presidential candidates and the Democratic National Committee, they would just as soon put the 2000 election behind them. They don't think they need to relive that to win Florida.
Brian, if the election were tomorrow, do you have any sense or any numbers on who would win Palm Beach County?
Well, I think if the election were held tomorrow, the Democrats would win Palm Beach County because it's still an overwhelmingly Democratic county.
Yep.
But the Republicans are making inroads here, and they are putting in a major effort here. And I think that, you know, the Republicans control every level of government in Florida. The Democratic Party is a shell of its former self. They have a lot of money and a lot of energy, and obviously with Governor Jeb Bush not looking forward to another 537-vote landslide for his brother, I think they're going to put extraordinary effort into at least closing the gap in counties like ours.
Florida primary on March 9th. How are the voting machines?
Our voting machines are actually pretty good. They have been tested in the 2002 governor's race and ran very smoothly. Not every county has the same kind of touch-style voting machine that we have. There were some controversy in Miami and the Fort Lauderdale areas about their voting machines, and continues to be some controversy about those voting machines. They had a glitch this week in a special election for a state legislative seat that cleared up fairly quickly, but there's still some concern about computer glitches. And probably the biggest concern about our voting machines here in Palm Beach County is that there's no paper trail. It's a pure touch screen system, and there's no piece of paper that spits out. And a lot of people fear that that will cause some problems in the general election.
Brian, a last quick question on the Democrats. What's the betting line on who will take Florida March 9th when that primary happens?
Well, the candidates have spent very little time in Florida. Joseph Lieberman is probably the best known of the candidates and obviously spent a great deal of time here during the last election and has spent a great deal of time here since that election. But none of them have campaigned very hard here. You know, they've come here and they've had private fundraisers now and again, and some of the candidates haven't been here at all. So depending on what's left after the big primaries on March 2nd,
yeah.
which candidates are left, I think in some ways it'll be a whole new battle if it gets as far as the Florida primary March 9th.
Yeah, March 9th is a very, very long time away politically. Brian Crowley, political editor of the Palm Beach Post in Florida. Brian, thanks an awful lot.
Thank you.
He was once considered a rising star in the National Republican Party, but these days Connecticut Governor John Rowland is begging to keep his job, literally. Rowland made an on-camera plea to Connecticut voters yesterday as federal prosecutors and the FBI look into charges of bid rigging and bribery in Rowland's administration and state legislators consider impeachment. The investigation began with accusations that the governor accepted free renovations and gifts at his cottage on Bantam Lake in Litchfield, which he at first denied with righteous indignation and yesterday apologized for, saying,
"I should know better, and I do know better. But I want you all to know that I have never, not once, provided any favors or taken any actions in exchange for the gifts that I have received. Still, as I face my problems, I ask no one to defend my actions. I ask no one for sympathy."
Well, did he get it anyway? John Lender is a reporter for the Hartford Courant. John, how do people react to that apology?
It's hard to say this quickly, but it doesn't seem to have really made too much difference. People said he seemed very nervous and was not as effective as he has been for years on television. He usually has quite a kind of commanding mastery that he kind of exudes on TV. And yesterday there were a lot of mention of how much he was gulping and licking his lips. Actually, people were talking in that much detail, and he seemed very nervous and tentative.
And this, as you say, this is one of Connecticut's longest-serving governors. He's a big vote getter. He's a big politician.
Yeah, in politics, it's amazing sometimes what it is that turns people's fortunes. I mean, in this case, there has been a more than year-long federal investigation into bid rigging in his administration, but it really hadn't affected people's regard for the governor until these revelations about this improvements to this little privately owned cottage that he has. And maybe it was on a scale that people could understand. He was getting things for free.
Like gutters and stuff like that.
Yeah, from a contractor who received more than $100 million worth of no-bid contracts from his administration. Hmm. So now the question, I mean, the thing he said, I never, in the speech that he stressed and that you mentioned in your intro, which is that no one ever received a benefit in exchange for any of the gifts or help that I got. That is going to be the crux of the federal investigation that is really boring in very, very hard on him now.
Well, as we mentioned also, there's talk of impeachment proceedings. Do you think it will get that far, or will the governor step down?
He has said flatly that he won't step down, and most people believe that. And the Democrats, it does seem, will probably go forward with convening an impeachment committee, which would begin a long, long process. It gives the prospect of a long, long process of proceedings with the backdrop of this federal investigation and the prospect of indictments to people high in his administration, in the governor's administration, and potentially him, everybody says. I mean, who knows? But we'll see what the federal investigators come up with.
Well, John, I know it's a story that all of Connecticut is focused on right now. Thanks for telling us about it.
Sure.
John Lender, a reporter for the Hartford Courant. He spoke to us from Hartford, Connecticut.
Is the insurgency in Iraq a textbook case? Just ahead, Major John Noggle has a doctorate for his study of counterinsurgency. He's now in Iraq putting theory into practice, and journalist Peter Moss spent 2 weeks with him.
And later, taxes, the middle class, Howard Dean, and body piercing?
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Major John Noggle is a West Point graduate, a Rhodes Scholar, and he won the Bronze Star in the Persian Gulf War. He then became a scholar, specializing in counterinsurgency. Now, Major Noggle's putting theory into practice. He got himself assigned as part of a tank battalion in Iraq. Writer Peter Moss recently spent 2 weeks with Major Noggle. He's written a piece about it in this Sunday's New York Times magazine. Peter Moss, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
Peter Moss, just to get started, first, draw us a quick sketch of Major John Noggle.
Well, he looks like a fairly ordinary fellow. I mean, he's not 6'4", built like a redwood or anything like that. He's, you know, normal size, 5'9", handsome enough, but not necessarily Hollywood ready. He has a very good sense of humor. He's a very funny man. He loves irony. He loves wit. He loves to make people laugh. But what's interesting about his use of humor is that in some ways he uses it as a test of his listener's intelligence to see if you can kind of get where the joke ends and the seriousness begins, because there's always a touch of seriousness to what he says.
This is a very smart guy, huh?
He is extraordinarily smart. I mean, he was a Rhodes Scholar, which, of course, you know, is an honor that few people get. But on top of that, he graduated virtually at the top of his class at West Point. There are about 1,000 students in each class, and he was number 23rd.
So, Peter, you spent 2 weeks with him. Attacks on U.S. troops are down from a high of 50 a day or so a few months ago to 15 or so now, as I understand it. And I think the Army would say, to a certain extent, that's because of much tougher tactics. In the past several weeks, they're breaking down doors, they're sweeping through neighborhoods, they're throwing hoods over prisoners' heads, which in the Arab world is considered particularly humiliating. How does Noggle, Major Noggle, feel about that approach that seems to be working?
For Noggle himself, in terms of the tactics used, what he's trying to accomplish, what everybody, particularly in the Sunni Triangle, is trying to accomplish, is this very fine calibration of force. You want to use enough force so that, A, you get the enemy, so that, B, the enemy that you don't get is intimidated, but that, C, you don't alienate the nonviolent population whose support you desperately need. One of the tenets of counterinsurgency, and Noggle knows this all too well, is that if you're only going after the guy with the gun, then you're only doing half of the job.
So that's the knife edge, and that's trying to eat soup with a knife. Is there any consistent thread, Peter, in your experience there, to how Iraqis are feeling about this occupation?
The American military thinks that actually it's not alienating more people than it's pleasing. There are, however, a large number of Iraqis, particularly in the Sunni Triangle, who indeed are unhappy with this. And Noggle is very straightforward about this himself. He understands that an army of occupation is almost by definition not going to be popular. I mean, imagine if, you know, we here in New York had at every street corner a tank of a foreign army, and that these soldiers didn't speak our language, and that they yelled at us and they shouted at us if we got in their way in traffic, and if they shot at us because we were following too close. He knows that occupation almost equals alienation, which is why the kind of nonviolent aspect of occupation is such a difficult task to achieve.
Peter, you finish your piece in the New York Times with a pretty chilling sentence. Let me read it. The goal the United States hopes to reach in Iraq, a successful counterinsurgency that does not drag on for years and does not involve a large amount of killing, has never been achieved by any army.
That's the historical record. At the turn of the century, the war in the Philippines, which is often regarded as one of the most successful counterinsurgencies in history, that involved, and it stretched for about a decade, really, a little bit more than that. That involved the deaths of about 4,000 American soldiers, about 20,000 rebels, and several hundred thousand civilians, many of them who were killed by disease that was sparked by the fighting. And that's one of the most successful counterinsurgencies.
So Major Noggle, more than most soldiers, knows that history. He's a scholar. He's a student of it. What does he think is going to happen in Iraq? How long are we going to be there?
He thinks that the United States will be successful, ultimately, in Iraq, and that it's on the road to success. But he also believes that it's going to be a long road. And as T.E. Lawrence said in this kind of remarkable and often cited passage in his book, Seven Pillars of Wisdom, war upon rebellion is messy and slow, and that's what it's going to be like in Iraq. It will be messy and it will be slow, and that means years, and that means bloodshed, and that means a high cost of victory to all sides.
Peter, what did he tell you jived and what didn't jive with his scholarly insight into counterinsurgency as compared to what he's experiencing now in the Sunni Triangle?
He told me that the books tell you what needs to be done. For example, you need to get good human intelligence, and then you need to act on the human intelligence. But they really didn't tell you how it's to be done. And he gave me an example. He said, look, you know, we have walk-ins all the time, people who come to us with information. And so somebody comes up to one of our checkpoints or comes to the base and says, there's a bad guy who lives in this house who's been launching mortars against you and planting IEDs. And so Noggle says to this informant, great, 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 where does this guy live? Well, the problem is that in Iraq, as Noggle explained to me, houses don't have numbers, streets don't have names, and every house looks the same. Mm. So you need to go with the informant to the house so he can point it out to you. But the informant doesn't want to get into a Humvee because then all of his neighbors and friends will see it and he'll be identified as a collaborator to the Americans, and the next morning he'll wake up dead. And so Noggle is faced just with this very simple task of, even when he has good human intelligence, being able to make it concrete is something that he hadn't known would be as difficult as it is. Of course, he's trying to find ways around this. And he can't, you know, for example, one of the solutions to that particular quandary that he mentioned is, well, you know, I could get into a Mercedes with normal clothes and drive this guy to the neighborhood and have him point it out, but I'm a regular soldier. I'm not allowed to get into a Mercedes and dress in normal clothes and do that. Mm. It's the kind of thing special forces do. So they're beginning to get special forces to kind of do things like that. But that's not necessarily terribly efficient. There aren't special forces there all the time. It's a really difficult task in which every little mission takes a lot more effort and a lot more ingenuity than in any book that he had read had prepared him for.
Writer Peter Moss has a piece on his 2 weeks in Iraq with Major John Noggle in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. It's a rich and fascinating piece. Peter Moss, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Tomorrow in Here and Now, Coming to America, we'll have a report from one of the most deadly border crossings in the U.S. across the Arizona desert.
And we talk to Oprah Winfrey's favorite rancher, the Mad Cowboy, who stopped eating meat. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink, technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, tax cuts for the middle class, igniting Democratic candidates and Republican ad writers.
Well, I think Howard Dean should take his tax hiking, government expanding, latte drinking,
Hollywood loving left-wing freak show back to Vermont, where it belongs.
And we know we're supposed to shake it like a Polaroid picture, but what does that mean?
I guess you're kind of like slapping your hand back and forth and shaking your butt.
It's like the booty shake for 2004.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. Another Black Hawk helicopter has gone down in Iraq. Karen Sloan is there.
9 U.S. service personnel were killed on board the helicopter that crashed. Brigadier General Mark Kimmett told a news conference the chopper was carrying out routine duties when it went down 4 miles west of Fallujah. That's the heart of what's known as the Sunni Triangle, an area that's a hotbed of insurgency against the U.S. occupation here. There's still no word about the cause of the crash, although helicopters have been shot at in the area before. One went down just last week, killing a soldier. The helicopter crash comes the day after rebels fired 6 mortars into a U.S. military logistics base in the same region, killing one soldier and wounding 34 other people. Karen Sloan, Baghdad.
There is late word that a witness says a rocket hit the tail of the medevac helicopter before it went down. A charge today that the Bush administration systematically misrepresented a weapons threat from Iraq. A private think tank maintains that Iraq posed no imminent threat to the U.S. and there was no solid evidence that President Saddam Hussein was cooperating with the al-Qaeda terror network. Researchers at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace say U.S. strategy should be revised to eliminate the policy of unilateral preventive war. The report recommended that consideration be given to making the job of CIA director a career post instead of a political appointment. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon will not get the approval of conservatives before moving ahead with a plan to dismantle settlements and impose a border on Palestinians. Sharon says he won't bring his proposals to the Likud Party's hawkish Central Committee. He outlined the plan last month, saying if there was not any move to end 3 years of violence between Israelis and Palestinians, he would move to separate the two groups. The Food and Drug Administration today rejected a bid to return silicone gel breast implants to the market more than a decade after they were banned. The decision surprised and won praise from women's and consumer advocacy groups who say the implants were too defective and harmful to women's health. The FDA apparently heeded criticism that the Inamed Corporation had not studied the implants thoroughly enough to settle questions about how often they break apart in women's bodies and the resulting health effects from leaking silicone. Retailers got better than expected sales in December. Last-minute holiday shoppers went on a big spending spree, providing the nation's retailers with enough sales to offset a slow start for the season. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Forget where they stand on the war in Iraq. The wedge issue opening up at the moment among Democrats running for president is tax cuts for the middle class. Some of frontrunner Howard Dean's opponents are scathingly criticizing the former Vermont governor's vow to repeal all of President Bush's tax cuts. Republicans are joining in, too. Listen to a new ad now playing in Iowa from the conservative group, the Club for Growth.
What do you think of Howard Dean's plans to raise taxes on families by $1,900 a year?
What do I think? Well, I think Howard Dean should take his tax hiking, government expanding, latte drinking, sushi eating, Volvo driving, New York Times reading,
body piercing, Hollywood loving, left-wing freak show back to Vermont, where it belongs.
Got it?
All right, we got it. Back to the Democrats, though. In this week's NPR radio debate, here's Senator John Kerry.
Howard Dean has a program to raise people's taxes beyond the increases they've already paid in tuition, because he's not lowering the tuitions, beyond their health care costs, because those are up. And so he's going to increase the burden on middle-class Americans.
I think we have to give Governor Dean an opportunity to respond.
Well, Governor Dean did respond. Hogwash, he said. But maybe the kitchen is getting a little too hot because Howard Dean may be changing his mind on middle-class tax cuts. Joining us on the line to talk about the politics of it all are David Yepsen, who's political editor of the Des Moines Register in Iowa. Hi, David.
Good to be with you.
And John Greenberg, executive editor at New Hampshire Public Radio. Hi, John.
How you doing?
John, let's start with you. How do we know that Governor Dean, former Governor Dean, is apparently ready to maybe step back a bit from middle-class tax cuts?
Because his top economic advisors have been talking to reporters about it, and they say that a new plan is in the works. So they actually say that they've been telling the candidate that he should have a modified tax proposal that would do some of this middle-class tax cut that's being talked about. They're playing their cards close to the chest as to when they're going to release it.
David Yepsen, in Iowa, does the fact that at the moment Howard Dean is calling for a repeal of all the Bush tax cuts, including for middle-class voters, are middle-class voters noticing that?
No. This is a nuance that is politically unimportant. What's propelling Howard Dean is a movement. He is, as we all know, capitalized on the anger over the war in Iraq. He has energized people with his blunt talk and his candor. His other opponents, are using every rock, club, brick they can find in an effort to slow him down. And this is just the latest one. I don't see it cracking Dean's support at all.
You know, I wonder here if what's really sort of the target of all of this discussion are the sort of the undecided voters, the independents, the swing voters. I don't see it really being a huge issue among the Democratic core. Would you agree?
I do. It may, in fact, be a bigger issue in New Hampshire than it is in Iowa because you allow independents to vote in your primary there, whereas here you have to be a registered Democrat. People just are not lined up discussing the nuances of Howard Dean's tax plan versus John Kerry.
Well, David, you know, you referred to the former governor's blunt talk and candor. You know, when he brings up the question of tax cuts, he says you can't have tax cuts and also come up with money to pay for entitlements like social spending, all that, help with college educations. Is that something that Iowa voters are hearing? That kind of, look, I'm just being honest with you thing.
Yes. And I think they like that kind of thing in him. I mean, here's a guy who he'll admit to making a mistake, he'll change his mind, and he turns that into a virtue. The problem right now that Dean faces is that the white-hot scrutiny of the media and his opposition is coming down on him. And some days he doesn't hold up too well under it. He gets a little prickly. But so far, I don't see it that it's hurt any of his support. I do think it may have slowed his momentum, particularly after the capture of Saddam Hussein.
John Greenberg, Congressman Richard Gebhardt is the only other candidate who's calling for a full repeal of President Bush's tax cuts, in his case, to pay for health care. He doesn't seem to be paying any political price for it in New Hampshire or anywhere else, right? How come?
Well, I think because Gebhardt's got other problems. He just is... He's kind of frozen where he is, and he doesn't seem to have really caught on and made a lot of progress. By the way, the Gephardt campaign put out a release yesterday. I don't know if you happened to see it, but in response to that Club for Growth ad, they basically say it's an ad that is intended to build support for Dean because it's clearly a completely over-the-top ad. It's hysterical, really. I mean, latte drinking, sushi eating, Volvo driving. I mean, on and on and on with all of the stereotypes. The Gephardt campaign is saying this is actually going to help Dean. There is a little bit of historical precedent for that because every time the Club for Growth has come out with an ad, or the previous time, it did actually give Dean a boost.
David, what do you think? It's a sharp, funny, somewhat bizarre ad. How does it cut?
Well, I think it is a funny and sharp, as you say. I'm not sure any one ad at this point in the campaign is going to have a breakthrough effect. I don't know about your airwaves, but out here the TV is just wall-to-wall with campaign commercials, and it's the political equivalent of Muzak. So everybody gets a good laugh out of this, and the campaign moves on.
David, anybody significantly gaining on Dean in Iowa? We've heard about even a mild breakout for Senator Kerry of Massachusetts.
There have been. I mean, you have in this state about a third of the activists are telling pollsters that they're for Dean. He was picking up nicely after Al Gore's endorsement. After Saddam's capture, his support flattened out. He really didn't lose anything, but he quit gaining. There are 20 to 25% of the Democrats who are undecided. Probably half of those who have expressed a preference for a candidate say they could be persuaded to change their mind. So everybody has an opportunity here. Kerry has picked up some. Kerry is actually closer to Gephardt for second place than Gephardt is to Dean for first at this point in the latest polling.
John Greenberg, we're going to have to finish up, but I want to ask you about General Wesley Clark, who, according to a USA Today poll this week, has come within 4 points of Dean nationally. Speaking of taxes, the general came out with his own tax plan this week. He wants to eliminate all income taxes for families earning under $50,000. How's General Clark doing in New Hampshire?
Well, he's definitely gaining some momentum here in the state. And it's very clear that for a number of people who are undecided, Clark is very much in the running. So I think that for people who have not committed themselves up to this point, Clark starts to look pretty interesting. I do not see him supplanting Dean, but I do see a scenario where if Kerry does not do well in Iowa, then Clark is probably going to be the main beneficiary here 8 days later in New Hampshire.
Fascinating few weeks coming up. John Greenberg, executive editor at New Hampshire Public Radio. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And David Yepsen, political editor of the Des Moines Register in Iowa. Thank you, David, and thank you both.
Thank you.
Still to come, they may call themselves outcast, but they've definitely gone mainstream. Even Wesley Clark is quoting them.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Here and Now. It's Thursday when we open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
Our recent segments on mad cow disease provoked a lot of listeners to email. Brian Greger wrote after hearing a spokesperson for the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. He writes, he is defending an industry that routinely places profits far above health and safety of workers and consumers, that willingly butchers sick cows for human feed. He can claim our food is safe from pathogens only because there is no testing system for them. If Walmart can manage to track tiny plastic widgets from factory to consumer, then surely the beef industry can manage to track a 1,000-pound cow.
Another interview that elicited a lot of listener response was our conversation with Canon David Anderson, a conservative member of the American Anglican Council who does not support gay clergy. Tim Orwig of Worcester, Massachusetts, felt that we should have elaborated on Canon David Anderson's background. So we called him and asked him what concerned him about our conversation with Canon Anderson.
Well, I love your show, but I was disappointed that you didn't challenge David Anderson more. What I find most troubling is that Anderson and his American Anglican Council have a political agenda to move the church to the right, funded with over $1 million in donations by Anderson's close friend and prayer partner, Howard Amundson. He's a guy who also funds efforts to force the teaching of creationism in public schools and putting web filters on public library computers. This is not really a crisis of conscience for David Anderson. It's a political campaign.
Tim Orwig, himself an Episcopalian. Tim, thanks so much for that insight.
Thank you much.
Our discussion about Time magazine's choice of the American soldier as its Person of the Year, with a cover featuring Army troops, inspired John Reeves of Charlotte, North Carolina, to write this letter. Where are the Marines and the Air Force and the Navy? I come from a Marine Corps family and am very proud of that fact. What Time neglected is that all of the services should have been recognized, not just the Army. The public may see soldier on the cover, but the armed forces see Army.
Our listeners also had a lot to say about our movie critics' contention that many movies these days are just too long. Jim Heck of Chelmsford, Massachusetts, had these comments. At nearly $10 for a movie ticket, I can't begin to tell you how cheated I feel when movies are short. I don't speed read, so why should I speed watch? I liked Lord of the Rings at 3.5 hours, and I can't wait to see the extended version, hopefully more than 4.
Well, listener Hillary Lederber wrote us recently, twice, with both praise and criticism. The criticism? Well, let's just say she didn't like the new Christmas CD from Canada's Jane Siberry. Hillary writes, "Someone should forbid her from ever going near music by Handel, Bach, or any other composer for that matter, again. Then again, perhaps one of the masters will rise up from turning over in their graves to strangle her for producing such a mockery of their great works." Well, fortunately, Ms. Lederberg continued listening and recently sent us this letter after our segment on Charles Ives. Here now redeemed itself, in my view, with a piece on Charles Ives. I took a 2-semester class at the New England Conservatory about Ives. Ever since, I'm convinced that history will look back on Charles Ives as by far the greatest American composer. Thank you for a story on real music.
Ah, we're so glad we want Hillary back. As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your name, phone number, and the town where you live.
I like Jane Siberry.
Someone has to.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Hey, you know what shake it like a Polaroid picture means?
It's like when the Polaroid comes out of the camera, you grab it and you shake it to make it develop faster.
That's a myth. It doesn't develop any faster.
And so now it really just means to shake your booty.
I guess you're kind of like slapping your hand back and forth and shaking your butt.
It's like the booty shake for 2004.
Shake it like a Polaroid picture is the line from the hit song Heya from the hip-hop duo Outkast. Polaroid has jumped on the very crowded Outkast bandwagon, launching a marketing campaign to get cameras into the hands of young fans, many of whom didn't have a clue what a Polaroid was until their favorite group told them to shake it.
Outkast is amazing.
But it's not rock, it's not rap, it's not any of those things. It's just its own unique sort of form.
But as you play through the whole song, it does that.
All right, all right, all right. Hey, ladies.
Yeah?
What's colder than cold?
Ice cold.
That's genius. It's a stroke of genius.
Outkast, Grammy-nominated for Album of the Year for the release that features Heya, Speaker Box, The Love Below, which is actually 2 CDs, one for each member of the duo. It also made most critics' end-of-year top CD lists. And here to say, I told you so, is Renee Graham, pop critic of the Boston Globe. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Robin.
You called it back in September. You said that Shake It Like a Polaroid Picture may be the line of the year.
Maybe the line of the decade.
But as you know, there are some people for whom this is totally new. So tell me, what is it that grabs you about, well, first of all, Heya?
It doesn't sound like anything else on the radio. I mean, you know, Outkast is essentially a hip-hop group, and people have this very fixed notion of what a hip-hop group is supposed to sound like. And here you've got this song with this sort of 60s soul vibe, and it's really loose and it's easy. And he's rapping a little bit, but he's more singing, you know, than actually rhyming. And
yes,
it's just,
but he's singing cheerfully about uncommitted love.
Yep.
and so are people walking
around. A happy
around.
Ode to casual sex.
Right, and people like Democratic candidate Wesley Clark are saying, I love that song. Do you think
think people really know what they're... I mean, obviously
do
some
I do. Think Wesley Clark is an Outkast fan? No, I do not. Do I think the line, shake it like a Polaroid picture, is about to be over if Wesley Clark is quoting it? Yes, I do. But I think it speaks to just how big this group has gotten. I mean, you know, this is their fifth album, but this is the album that really broke them for a lot of people who had somehow managed to miss their earlier work.
Well, first of all, remind us, two guys, friends since school.
Two guys, Andre 3000, whose name is Andre Benjamin, and Big Boy, whose name is Antoine Patton, met in high school in Atlanta, got to know each other, and actually put their first single out when they were just out of high school, still teenagers, called Player's Ball.
Yeah. It's beginning to look a lot like wood. Follow my every step. Take notes on how I crept. I was about to go in depth. This is the way I greet my season. Here's my guess to rep. I kept...
When Player's Ball came out, it was late 1993, and that was the moment when the sort of G-Funk era of West Coast hip-hop and Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg really took off. So there was this whole sort of move to this much harder-edged rap, and suddenly you had this group coming out of Atlanta who could certainly thug it up with everybody with...
Could what?
Thug it up.
Oh, thug it up. Okay.
Thug it up with the best of them, but they also had all these other ideas. They had these really cool pop culture references, and not always references that... were the most current, which is, you know, which is why you'd have something like Shake It Like a Polaroid Picture in their current song. They just had this very different idea about what hip-hop could be, and it was managed to be old school and also very forward-thinking.
And they created their own little world. I'm thinking of Stankonia.
Stankonia.
Let's hear a little bit off of that early release. It's from 2000. It won a Grammy as Best Rap Album.
Never meant to make your daughter cry.
If I'm lying, fine. The quickest muzzle, throw it on my mouth and I'll decline. King meets queen, then the puppy love thing. Together dream about that crib with the Goodyear swing. On the oak tree, I hope we feel like this forever, forever.
Ms. Jackson off Stankonia, which had something of a message.
It did have a message, and it was a very personal song. You know, they both perform the song, but the song is really about Andre 3000's relationship with his baby's mother, who's actually the singer Erykah Badu. And the song is a message to the grandmother, and he's sort of saying, look, our relationship fell apart, but I'm still going to be a parent to my son. I'm going to be there on graduation. I'm going to be there on the first day of school. And it was this extraordinary song because people just didn't realize that at that time that hip-hop songs would still be about such things and this sort of drama that everyone has to go through.
Well, and on the other hand, on their new release, I don't want to be a party pooper here, but some of the lyrics would be very offensive to some, referring to women with the B word. A young girl talks about sex with the F word.
You know, at its core, it's still hip-hop. It's still modern music. But at the same time, they can get very graphic in talking about sex, but you never get the idea that the woman is just a semen receptacle, which is usually the case in most hip-hop songs. You know, there's a sense of a partnership going on there. You know, I call this album Speaker Box and The Love Below, it's the hip-hop album for people who don't really like hip-hop, especially The Love Below, which is Andre 3000's half. It has, you know, the album opens with him crooning like Nat King Cole.
Unbelievable, the lush sounds, and I thought I had the wrong CD on the first time.
Strings and tinkling pianos, yeah. And you sort of listen to it and you're like, this is a hip-hop album? But that's the whole point.
Some say Atlanta. Some say New York. Some say Patty Friends, but who knows? Where this flower grow.
From its beginnings, hip-hop culture, and if you look at hip-hop culture as, you know, the art, graffiti, the dance, breakdancing, and the music, rap, was always about having no boundaries. It was deconstructing everything that came before and making it into something new. And Outkast has managed to continue doing that and just doing it brilliantly.
By the way, the other Outkast hit right now, The Way You Move, represents the other CD in the release.
That's Big Boy's contribution right now from his side of the CD, the speaker box. And what, again, it's that Outkast thing. It sounds absolutely nothing like Hey Ya. His is much more, people keep calling it much more of a conventional hip-hop song, but it still doesn't sound like anything else that's out there. It's just smart and playful and danceable. It's a beautifully produced song, and they did produce this themselves.
Ready for action, nip it in the bud, we never relaxing. Outcast is everlasting, not clashing, not at all. But see, my nigga went to do a little acting. Now that's for anyone asking, give me one and pass them. Drip, drip, drop, there goes an orgasm. Now you coming out the side of your face, we tapping right into your memory bank. Thanks. So click at the ticket, let's see your seatbelt fastened. Trunk rattling, like 2 minutes in the back seat wrestling. Speaker box vibrate the tag, make it sound like aluminum cans in the back.
Okay, Renee, I gotta ask you two questions. You're a woman of color. The word, the N-word that they use doesn't bother people? Does bother people?
You know, I would say that when it really became prevalent in hip-hop, which would have been like, especially the late 80s with N.W.A., it did bother me. At this point, I'm sorry to say it, I'm used to hearing it in hip-hop. It doesn't make me flinch the way it used to.
And second question, the fact that there were two CDs on this one release, there's all sorts of rumors that indicates the group is splitting up, the duo's breaking up.
I know, it's a natural, you know, conclusion for people to draw. I don't really see that. I just think that this was an effort. There was so much music there, they didn't want to put on the back burner, and they just saw this as a way of putting it out there.
Mm. Well, Renee Graham, I mean, it sounds as if, are they a shoo-in for the Grammys they're nominated for?
You know, at this point, the Ozmakers, you know, are saying that they will likely win Album of the Year, which would make it only this. They make them only the second rap act to win Album of the Year. Lauryn Hill won for The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill in 1999. They were nominated. Stankoni was nominated for Album of the Year a few years ago, but I think this is their year. I mean, they've got 6 nominations, and I think it could really be their night.
Well, Renee, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Renee Graham with her outlook on Outkast. Renee covers pop culture for the Boston Globe, and she's also here now as film reviewer.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Shake it like a Polaroid picture and get it to your radio.
Get into your radio and join us again here and now.
You think you've got it, oh, you think you've got it, but got it, just don't get it till there's nothing at all. We get together, oh, we get together, but separate's always better when there's feelings involved.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now.
Coming to America, we'll have a report from one of the most dangerous border crossings in the U.S.
And we talk to Oprah Winfrey's favorite rancher, the mad cowboy, who stopped eating meat.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.